Hello and welcome. My guest today needs little introduction, especially since the proper introduction would consume the entirety of this broadcast. He has excelled in most or all of his career choices: United States Navy UDT SEAL, professional wrestling, politics, radio and television broadcasting, and writing. As the 38th governor of Minnesota, Jesse Ventura got a first-hand look at this country's politics up close, and some of the things he saw, frankly, scared him. And as he mentions in his latest book, American Conspiracies, he doesn't scare easy. Welcome, Governor.
Thank you, David. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you coming on. You know, Governor, I did read your whole book, and it's fascinating. First chapter starts with the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, goes through 14 chapters and an epilogue. And I just want to make one thing clear before we begin. The title of the book, American Conspiracies, it's a bit of a misnomer due to the fact that nearly every alternative explanation for a significant event gets labeled with the pejorative term conspiracy. In fact, you clearly state in the epilogue, in fact, on the last page of the book, and I'll quote, "It's not based on my opinion, folks. It all came from documentation. It was a matter of putting together the pieces that the media no longer pays attention to." And I'll tell you, the first thing that scared me was when you talked about, you said the first inkling, and this is in the introduction, that certain people inside the federal government were out to keep an eye on you came not long after you took office, when they had that meeting in the basement of the Capitol building. Can you tell us about that, Governor?
Well, what it was a request from the Central Intelligence Agency for me to participate in the training exercise, they called it. So if I take them for their word, it was simply training. But I don't always take them for their word. And there were 23 men. I was requested to the bowels of the Capitol of Minnesota. I'd been in office for maybe a month. I can't remember exactly. It's a few years ago. And, you know, I'm a patriotic person and felt that, well, sure, if I can help them out and help the country out, why not? And so it also piqued my curiosity a little bit, because I had never before been interviewed by the Central Intelligence Agency. And when I got down there for the interview, it was very interesting, because first I asked them questions. They put me in the center and they had a big half circle around me. And the kind of scary part about it was, as I looked at these 23 people, they were your neighbors.
Right.
I mean, what I mean by that is they were every age bracket, every skin color. I mean, you saw old women there that looked like the lady down the street that sweeps her step off every morning. And that was kind of weird to me, because I thought, wow, you know, these people could be infiltrated all through us and no one would ever know. So I asked them first. I said, I have a question. And I said, I'd like to know, what are you doing here? I said, you're not supposed to be operational inside the United States according to your charter. Well, they didn't want to field that question too much. And then I said, I want to go around the room, tell me your name and what you do. Well, I got no cooperation on that, hardly.
Well, you were only the governor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm just the governor, you know, and I used to have a top secret security clearance when I was in the teams in the Navy,
right. But
I guess that didn't matter. And then, of course, they did begin questioning me. They were very formal, you know, they was governor, it was sir, and it was all that, you know, they were very respectful. But all the questions pertained to how did I get elected. And when the meeting was over and I was going home that night, I kept thinking about it. So I called my friend Richard Marcinko, who's the author of the Rogue Warrior books, 32-year member of Navy SEAL, created the Elite SEAL Team 6 and all that.
Okay.
And I wanted Dick's thoughts on it, because he's a good friend. And I thought, you know, he'll be straight with me. We're both old teammates. And he was. You know, he said naturally he didn't know. He kind of laughed when I told him the scenario. And he said, well, I don't know exactly, but I got an idea. And I said, well, shoot, let me hear it. And he said, I don't think they saw you coming. And their job is to gather intelligence, and they probably want to know, is there four or five more of you independents on the horizon that they don't know about? But then later on, a few days later, I kept thinking about it, and I came up with a second alternative scenario that I think may be even more accurate than what Dick's was. And that is this: maybe they needed to interview me to gain knowledge so that they could prevent any independent like me from ever winning again.
Why is the CIA involved in domestic politics? I know you said that earlier, but how do they get away with it?
Yeah. How? And then, of course, the bigger event than that, and I've spoke about it in my last two books because I wanted for sure the public to understand this, is that the CIA is embedded in all state government.
Right. Did you say that here in the introduction also? I was just
right. There's a member of the CIA who does double duty. He works in the government at a fairly upper echelon type position where he doesn't serve at the pleasure of the governor. He's a civil employee that is there all the time, but then does double duty as an agent for the CIA, and the only people made aware of this was myself, the governor, and my chief of staff. Not even the lieutenant governor was made privy to this. And then halfway through my term, the person retired, and a new person was named, and so that I then had to meet the new person, who then was replacing.
It was nice enough to let you to let you know who the CIA operative was. I wonder if they do that now.
I don't know. I don't know if they do or not, but, I kept thinking to myself, well, wait a minute. Minnesota can't be the exception. So I made the leap, and I thought, they must have one in every state government. Why would it only be little Minnesota?
Right, exactly. Because you're there.
Well, maybe so, but no, this person was there before I got there. This person was already embedded. It wasn't that the person all of a sudden showed up a week after I took office.
That's right. So what you're saying is that in every state government...
Well, that's what I would have to assume, because, again, Minnesota can't be the exception to the rule.
Why would they be in Minnesota, exactly?
Yeah, and not in other places like New York or California or anything like that, which are far, far bigger and play
Absolutely.
A much bigger role.
It's scary. And your book, American Conspiracies, right now is on the New York Times bestseller list, sitting for nearly a month. It might be a month. And the list I have shows 3 weeks, but I think it's 4 weeks.
And yeah, it's 4 weeks now. We came in the top 10 again.
Right. It's currently occupying the number 6 spot. That's up from one spot from the previous week. And as you can see, if you go to the New York Times bestseller list, of course, it hasn't been reviewed by the New York Times.
No, my book has not been reviewed by any major mainstream media publication. USA Today hasn't reviewed it. No one has. The only people reviewing it are the alternative media. Tell you, some of them are giving it 5-star. In fact, I just spoke with my co-writer, Dick Russell. He informed me that one of the reviews said, this book is so important because it's an alternative history book.
That's right. Exactly.
They're viewing it as an alternative history book, and I'm very proud of that fact.
It's a terrific book, and I just want to go through a quote here that I thought was very applicable to your book, because your book is an alternative history book, of course, because we weren't taught the things that you're teaching in this book. I grew up in the United States, of course, on the East Coast, New Jersey, and we never learned the things that you have put together in this book. And Arthur Schopenhauer, who was a German philosopher, 1788 to 1860, he said, all truth passes through 3 stages. First, it is ridiculed. Second, it is violently opposed. Third, it is accepted as being self-evident.
I guess
you're in the ridicule stage, I would imagine. And then, of course, they're going to have to violently oppose what you're saying. To start off with Abraham Lincoln, it wasn't just John Wilkes Booth, was it?
No, not at all. You had 8 people involved that were tried and convicted, 4 of them sentenced to death, including the first woman in United States history sentenced to death. Now, isn't that a historical moment?
Why didn't we learn about it?
Yeah, and they're still not, because as I was doing the book last summer, one of my nephews was over at my house. He's 15, and I happened to ask him, I said, what do you know about the death of President Abraham Lincoln? And he kind of perked up. He said, oh, we had that 2 weeks ago in school. I said, really, what did they, and he went through the whole scenario of John Wilkes Booth, and it ended right there.
Right.
He knew nothing about any other conspiracy of 8 people. He knew nothing about 4 of them being put to death. None of that. All it ended at John Wilkes Booth. And I think personally that's done so that it's everybody gets in tune with the lone nut assassin.
Exactly. And as you said in your book, it's amazing how these lone nuts can pull off these assassinations, but somehow they tend to leave a trail that it was them.
Oh, not only a trail, but they were miserable failures at everything else they did.
Except for that.
Except for that event. And there they were as good as you could possibly be, except they got caught.
We didn't learn about Lincoln. We certainly didn't learn about that conspiracy against FDR. That was fascinating.
I didn't know a thing about that until we got into this book.
Major
when Dick Russell researched that information, I almost fell out of the chair when I was reading it about General Smedley Butler.
That's right. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Well, what it was, you have the same thing today that's going on right now.
Mm-hmm.
President Roosevelt had brought us out of the Depression, and Wall Street, the power brokers of Wall Street, were accusing him of turning the country socialist. Does it sound familiar?
Yeah.
of what's happening right now with President Obama. He's accused of socializing the country. Well, they then got together and tried to do a coup d'etat of taking out Roosevelt, and they had General Smedley Butler, a real patriot, waiting in the wings, which was a perfect choice, because here's a two-time Congressional Medal of Honor winner. Who's going to question him? And his patriotism. And they were setting Smedley Butler up to be the interim president when they took out Roosevelt with this coup d'etat. But the thing they didn't count on was General Smedley Butler truly was a patriot, and he immediately after hearing it came forward and went to Congress and turned them all in. But then again, there were no trials. It was just quietly swept under the rug.
Right. Again, we didn't learn about this growing up here in the United States.
Not a bit. I never had that in any history class I took.
No, not at all. These corporations were planning on knocking off or liquidating or quarantining the democratically elected president of the United States in 1933 or 1934, and we have not learned anything about this. And until really, and I never heard anything about it, and I read quite a bit. I know you do.
Sure.
And looking at this, I never even heard of this guy Smedley Butler.
Yeah.
Why aren't
they? No.
Why, this is a conspiracy. It has to be. What else is it?
Well, you know what else is even more interesting is Smedley Butler died in 1940, and prior to that, he wrote his memoirs as a U.S. Marine, and at that time, he said, I did nothing but be the strong arm of corporate America throughout the world of going out and waging these wars on behalf of corporate America. And this was back previous to 1940.
I read that.
And that's exactly what our wars are today. They're battles for corporate America, oil, and all of those things that the corporations want to control.
You know, I told you this when we spoke earlier in the week, and it's kind of scary. It makes you think, were we ever the country that we thought we were? Ideally, were we ever this great, good? I mean, when did it all turn into conspiracies and mostly men who really don't care how many people die? And has it always been like that? Or, I mean, it seemed like the country just is deteriorating.
Well, to me, in modern day, the downfall was the assassination of President Kennedy, modern-wise, in my lifetime. Let's put it that way, because I wasn't alive when Roosevelt was president. I certainly wasn't alive when Lincoln was, but I was alive when John Kennedy, I was 11 or 12 years old, whatever it was, when President Kennedy was killed. And to me, that's the key one, because if you can get away with murdering the president, what can't you get away with?
That's absolutely right. Your chapter 3 is on JFK, and
right.
There's some things in there, again, that I've never been introduced to.
Let me give you the latest that I've learned that isn't even in the book.
Please.
Well, you know how there's the three bullets, right?
Right.
Okay. The first bullet missed and struck the curbing and injured this man, Mr. Teague, so they had to account for that because there was photos of it and all of that. Okay. The second bullet's the magic bullet that did all those amazing things.
Right.
And then, of course, the third bullet's the headshot. Well, the key to it is the bullet that missed. Everyone has dissected the headshot. They've dissected the magic bullet. But the key that I have learned, and I learned this from Fletcher Prouty's book, Colonel Prouty, the bullet that missed and struck the curb, if you go on a straight line back towards the Kennedy limo, because you have to assume it was a near miss because of the accuracy of the second two bullets.
Okay.
Right?
Right.
If you go on a straight line through the Kennedy limo and go beyond, it goes right to the second floor of the Daltex building, which is where many of us think there was a second shooter team, and then, of course, the third team was the grassy knoll, and then, of course, the book depository was the other one.
Right.
Now, if you take a straight, and as far as I know, in all my experiences as a Navy SEAL,
mm-hmm.
bullets go straight.
Yeah, that kind of
makes I've sense. Learned that. They go straight.
Right.
Well, if you go straight from that curb hit to Oswald's shooting nest, get this,
yep.
He's 22 feet high and 33 feet wide. Let me spitball here a little.
Okay.
Would the government then come out and tell me, well, here's our explanation for that. He took a warm-up shot to make sure the weapon worked.
Right, okay.
You know, that's all I could come up with is what they could say, because, I mean, after all, they created the magic bullet that did 7 wounds and all this remarkable stuff and was in pristine condition found in a cot in Parkland Hospital. And so what other explanation could be given? He must have decided to take a warm-up shot.
Really, the book is just filled with so much stuff. I don't want to talk about it all simply because I think it makes most sense if folks go out and buy their own copy, because it is something very important. People really need to get this information input into their brains. So once they learn what it is you're saying and what you're teaching, I think that they're going to be able to more successfully interpret information. If you close off any possibility of what you're introducing, I think it would be problematic for most people to do that. We spoke the other day and had a little technical difficulty. I didn't get a chance to bring this up to you, but on page 199, you say that to this day, every time you start appearing on national TV or radio, all of a sudden your phones get weird, you hear clicks on the other end, and your wife can't get online as quickly, and things disappear from her computer. Is this happenstance? It always seems to coincide with when I take a high profile. And what happened to me, Governor, was that, as you know, our entire conversation was not recorded, and that never happened to me before. So my
we may have another budding conspiracy right here.
I didn't tell you this before. My mouse started to act weird. Something happened. I don't know what it was. You talk about Malcolm X.
Let me make a point on that.
Please.
The one murder or conspiracy I believe that we missed in the book that I wish we would have done, even though I make a little reference to it, is the, also the killing of John Lennon.
John, right. That was in 1980, right?
Right. Now, here's a good question for you.
Okay.
What does the killing of John Lennon, Malcolm X, and Dr. Martin Luther King, what do all three of those murders have in common?
The only thing I could think about is that they were all like revolutionary type characters.
Nope. Okay. Here's what they all have in common, those three. They were all, at the time they were killed, under heavy government surveillance.
So Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr.
and John Lennon.
And John Lennon were all under heavy government surveillance. I have to ask you, what was a musician, a Beatle, doing under...
That's what I thought. When I read this book called The Killing of John Lennon, I was stunned. I've heard from other people now that Lennon, absolutely, he knew that he was under surveillance. That the government of this country did not like John Lennon because he was a powerful force for the left. Let's remember, he was killed in 1980, just after Ronald Reagan was elected. Okay, so the country was making this swing to the right, and Lennon was just coming out of that 5 years of self-imposed exile of raising his son and doing all that, and he was back doing music, and he was going to come back very high profile, I think. And I'm not too sure that there weren't people that didn't want that to happen.
That was about a month after the election.
Yep.
That he was killed.
Well, and let's remember about that election, because that's the first stolen election.
That's right, and that's another chapter of your book.
Yep, because
right.
That's the one where Bush and William Casey, who later headed the CIA, went over to France and cut the deal with the Iranians to hold on to the hostages until after Reagan got elected.
Right, so in other words, they could have freed these people who were there for over a year, but they wanted to keep them there longer.
They made them political pawns in their political game.
And what repercussions did they suffer?
Oh, nothing.
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 No investigations, nothing.
No, nothing.
Right.
And I mean, they were released, what, an hour after Reagan was sworn in?
I think it was even, right, it was almost like Dura, he's raising his hand and they're smiling,
yeah.
And getting out.
And I guess that's just circumstance again.
Right. It's,
you know, it just happened to happen that way. Well, remember what Colonel Fletcher Prouty said very clearly in his book?
Right.
He said, nothing just happens. Everything is planned.
Prouty, you mentioned him earlier. You said that you really recommend that folks go out and...
Oh,
yeah.
Well, who Fletcher Prouty is, if you go to the movie JFK by Oliver Stone...
Right.
Do you remember when Kevin Costner, the Garrison character, said, I've got to go to Washington. The guy won't come here, but he says he knows everything we need to know.
I remember
and
that.
And he flies out to Washington and he meets Donald Sutherland. Remember,
that's
all
right,
dressed
right.
in black?
Right.
That is Colonel Fletcher Prouty.
Where he told him you have to follow who would benefit from that, right?
So yep, because when Stone did JFK, of course, the mainstream media immediately attacked him over the fact they said, this Mr. X character, he's made up. You use that to just make up this story, fill in the blanks, and make your conspiracy whole.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Stone took it until he got in front of the National Press Club.
Right.
And they started in again on him, and when they were done, Stone said, no. He goes, Mr. X is real. In fact, he's up here on the dais with me. Let me introduce you to Mr. X. Two people down, Colonel Fletcher Prouty. I'll bet you that set the media back quick.
That's another major theme in your book, is the mainstream media, that, again, there's so much to read and so much to get out of it, but it seems like the major theme of the mainstream media pretty much ignoring, just like they were ignoring your New York Times bestseller book, but ignoring pretty much everything that would embarrass somebody in power. How do they do it?
Well, because I'll tell you why. Because if the mainstream media goes against the government on anything, they will lose their access.
So it's all about access.
Well, what good are you as a media if you don't have access to the most powerful people in the country?
Right, exactly.
What if you're not allowed? What if you do go against them and they don't let you into any more press conferences?
And you're done.
You're done.
Right.
And so there's the extortion or whatever that happens.
Well, it's working great because, as you point out, I mean, I wrote down probably about 20 to 25 individual examples that you point out where the media basically ignored what they should have. I mean, they're supposed to be paying attention to these things, but they're downright ignoring them.
They're supposed to be the fourth branch of government.
Right. Exactly.
Back when this country was created, the media was supposed to be the watchdog of the other three branches. And we've lost that watchdog.
Did we have it, though?
I don't know, because I didn't live far enough back then to know. But I know that's what our forefathers that created the country had in mind when they had the First Amendment and all that, the right to free speech and everything, because that's what protected and opened the door up to where the media did have the ability to hold their feet to the fire.
I keep getting back to this. Have we been the country that, I mean, you were in the Navy, I was in the Navy. Were we ever the country that we idealize the country?
Well, I think personally that our forefathers are turning over in their graves that we have an income tax.
Right.
Because you know what the income tax does, don't you? It makes the government number one.
Right.
Because they get your money first. So therefore, you're number two. And I don't think our forefathers ever had in mind the government being the main entity of this country and the people being the secondary.
No, they wanted the government to fear the people, not the other way
around. Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And that's the problem we have today. The government doesn't fear us. We fear them.
Absolutely. The other major theme, I found three major themes in your fine book. One, of course, the mainstream media. The other one being, and we talked about this briefly, the CIA. It seems like there are many companies. Like you mentioned, AIG, American International Group, has major ties to the CIA, as do a lot of other corporations. It seems like the CIA, besides the fact that, as you mentioned earlier, they're in probably every state house in the country, it looks like they're running the show.
Well, I think they're a rogue element, and Alan Dulles is the one responsible for it. And, of course, he sat right on the Warren Commission.
Right.
Because I'm reading the book you got to read also. It's called The Secret Team. By Fletcher Prouty. It was printed in 1972 and banned. You couldn't get it. You should read the part just about how difficult it was to get the book out by Prouty then in 1972. It's called The Secret Team.
He lays it
all out. He tells you exactly. He explains that the elected officials, like the president and the leadership, these things are already happening, and they find out about it after it's already being implemented. Virtually, they have no way of going against it or anything. They have to go along with it at that point.
So this is kind of like a shadow government.
Yeah, and it's within the government. It's a level of the government. He said the key people are these briefers, because that's what he was. Mm-hmm. The guys that do the briefs, like when McNamara came back on Vietnam, well, he gets briefed about it from the briefing people. He just reads the briefing papers and then passes those along to the president. But those briefing papers are all slanted to whatever it is of this layer of government wants to see happen.
So they have plausible deniability.
Sure.
Right, because they're not taking part in the implementation of it. They're just reading briefs. It's done behind the scenes, kind of like an iron triangle. The democratically elected officials are not even involved in policy.
Yeah.
And the other major theme I found in your book, disturbing also, is our government's role in running illegal drugs.
Yeah. Well, that's done. Let me explain why.
Right.
Okay, any government agency has to be responsible back to the Congress, because the Congress is who gives them their money.
Right.
So therefore, they have to submit reports. What are you doing? Well, if you want to run independent and do whatever you want to do, then get yourself an outside revenue source. And so by running drugs and making thousands, millions of dollars, well, they can do any op they want to do then, and they don't have to be responsible for it. They don't have to tell anybody what they're doing, because there's no paper trail.
Right. In fact, you do say in your book that in the founding of the CIA in 1947, they had started dealing drugs in that year.
Yeah.
And they fed drugs to United States citizens.
Yeah.
And they probably continue to.
Right. And then, of course, it evolved into that MK Ultra program.
Right. Can you explain a little bit about what that is?
Well, MK Ultra was in the 50s, 60s, and it was exposed in the early 70s, although most of the documents were all destroyed. They burned them all. The CIA and the government was using LSD and all of these drugs and attempting to create Manchurian candidates or super soldiers.
Okay.
People who could go out and kill someone and then have no memory of what they did, so there'd be no way to get caught in any type of conspiracy because the person doesn't remember what happened.
Right.
This is all documented. This stuff is all real.
But they destroyed it, right? It was documented, and then they destroyed
the Well, they did temporarily. Now there's a lot of feeling that it's back again. There's a lot of feeling out there that the program may have been rejuvenated again.
You talked about Robert Kennedy, of course, and his alleged assassin was Sirhan Sirhan. It seems what they have in common is they seem to be in some kind of a trance.
Well, yeah. Well, the guy, Mark David Chapman, who killed Lennon.
Right.
Well, his background, he hated guns, never used them. He was not a Beatle fanatic, like he was reported in the paper that he was a fanatic of the Beatles and obsessed with John Lennon. Completely untrue. When they spoke to his friends, they said, no, he didn't care much about the Beatles. In fact, they said his favorite musician was Todd Rundgren. And the night he killed Lennon, he dropped into a professional shooting position, put four or five rounds in Lennon in such a pattern it would make a drill instructor proud. Then here's, okay, he had three modes he could have escaped. He could have ran right across the street into Central Park, and we all know you can get lost there quick.
Absolutely.
He could have gone a half a block down and went into the subway, or he could have just got lost on the streets of Manhattan. Instead, here's what he did. He stepped back in the shadows, dropped the weapon, pulled out the Catcher in the Rye and was reading The Catcher in the Rye when the police arrived. That's some pretty bizarre behavior.
So here's a guy who wasn't a Beatle fan, was afraid of weapons, and he did something completely out of the ordinary. And if you question that, or if you cite clear evidence that the MK Ultra program, which people look at you like you have nine heads.
Yep, absolutely. And that's how they get away with it.
You talk in Chapter 11 about the stolen election of 2000 and 2004, and of course you said almost 2008.
Remember in the 11th hour when McCain said he thought there was going to be a huge turnaround?
Right.
Remember that?
Yes, what was that?
Well, that would be if they tamper with the electronic voting machines again. The thing about the electronic voting machine is this. It can be hacked into like any computer.
Exactly.
And the deal with it is, and the best way to put it is this way. Would you go to an ATM machine that didn't offer you a receipt?
I get the receipts every time.
Absolutely. Well, electronic voting machines don't offer a receipt. When you push the button, you have no way of knowing whether that vote was recorded for the candidate you chose.
The most important process in our democracy, and we can't get a receipt.
Yeah. And then how do you do a recount? Because all it gives you is like an adding machine. It just gives you the numbers.
So it can be
manipulated. So if you have to do a recount, how can you individually count the votes? You can't. And why don't they make the voting as simple as, like I've said, take the pencil and fill in the dot.
Right.
And if you're not capable of doing that, you shouldn't be voting. And because you've been doing that since first grade.
Exactly right.
You know, you take a test in first grade. It's called multiple choice. You circle the one that you think is the right answer. And in voting, there is no right answer. You can circle anyone you want.
Right. They're pounding us to death with the census. But with voting, they want to make it especially hard to understand.
And then you got this part of it, too. Diebold or Diebold, the only company that has monopolized these electronic voting machines. Well, it turns out they're a huge contributor to the Republican Party. They're the monopoly. They are the ones in control. The 204 election in Ohio,
right.
Why were the votes channeled to a company, a building in Chattanooga, Tennessee?
That's in your book. I did read that. I have no
idea.
It's disturbing. The whole thing, it really is disturbing. That's why it's so important that people read it. In fact, I think, for me anyway, the most disturbing part of the book was your chapter 12 on 9/11. And everybody is very much affected by that. And I just want to read something you wrote here on page 143. You say, today, though, I am convinced that, and of course I, meaning you, Jesse Ventura, I am convinced that some people inside our government knew the attack was going to happen and allowed it to come to pass because it furthered their political agenda. I don't necessarily believe that they orchestrated it themselves, although the door is definitely open to that. I say this after expending many hours researching things about the official story that don't add up and interviewing a number of witnesses with firsthand knowledge that contradicts what we were told. As a patriotic American, I say this with a heavy heart and with an outrage that really knows no words. But it's something we as a nation must come to terms with. Otherwise, it could happen again.
Yeah.
And that's very important.
Well, let's remember this also. This wasn't a new idea. This was a repeat of some history.
9/11.
9/11.
Right.
Because if you go back, two examples, the Reichstag fire in Germany.
Right.
Well, this was an important building to the Germans. I believe it housed their Congress or whatever. And it was burnt to the ground, and Hitler convinced the German people that it was done by the communists, which got them it fired up to go to war against Russia, which they were successful at achieving because they went to war against Russia. Well, then it turned out a couple of years later through the investigation, it turned out the Nazis burned it down themselves.
Right.
And then step forward more recently to the Gulf of Tonkin incident.
Right.
They've now admitted it was made up. It never happened.
Right,
and that's the catalyst that put us in the Vietnam War, where 58,000 of my generation were killed, and who knows, probably well over a million Vietnamese killed.
Right. And civilians, of course.
Yeah, all over something that never happened?
It never happened, right. And most Americans probably aren't even aware of the Gulf of Tonkin being a manufactured event.
Yeah.
What year did you go into the Navy, Governor?
I enlisted, ironically, September the 11th of 1969.
Okay. So you went in 9/11/69. Of course, the year before that, on June 8th, actually 2 years before that, 1967, during the Arab-Israeli Six-Day War, was when the Navy ship...
The Liberty.
That's right. The Liberty was...
Was strafed, blown up, and bombed by the Israelis, and that was completely covered up.
That's right. And could 9/11 be another Liberty?
It certainly could. In fact, I just read the book. It was handed to me on the book tour on the Liberty. I just read it.
Okay, with The Assault on the Liberty by Jim
Ennis?
Yeah.
Very interesting book.
9/11. What did you find out about that?
About 9/11?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, they knew very well about that these attacks could happen. They knew as early as May, because let's remember, first of all, let's go back to a few of these investigations. Whitewater, right?
Okay, right.
They spent $100 million to learn that the president cheated on his wife.
$100 million.
$100 million. After stonewalling a 9/11, because you remember how they stonewalled any investigation for 2 years?
Right.
Okay, after stonewalling any investigation, they finally gave in. You know how much money they allocated to investigate the death of 3,000 people?
How much?
$4 million.
I just wanted to regress a second. When we mentioned the Liberty, you read the book, very sad when Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara personally ordered the jets off of a couple of carriers there, I think it was the America or the Constellation, to stand down. He returned them. The USS Liberty was under fire from the Israelis, and this same exact thing happened with 9/11, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah,
because,
NORAD.
Because NORAD was, well, do you know what happened there? In June, early June, up until early June of 2001, it was left up to base commanders to make the call.
Right.
If the FAA called and said they had a problem in the air, the base commanders could make the call to scramble jets and get them up there.
Okay.
Then there was an executive order, June of 2001, where that order was rescinded, and any scrambling of jets required approval from the DOD, the Department of Defense.
A few months before 9/11.
Yeah, 3 or 4 months before 9/11. So in essence, what that meant was this. All you had to have for a stand-down then was for Donald Rumsfeld not to answer the phone.
And that's exactly what happened, right?
Yep.
Yep, as you said.
So they couldn't put any jets up in the air because they couldn't get approval to do it. And now, guess what I heard now? It's back to the old way again.
So they switched it back.
Yeah, after they accomplished what happened.
I think that's what prevents them from accepting this type of theory, that could their own government be responsible for this?
Well, let me put it to you this way. Bill Clinton one time said one of the scariest things I ever heard. You know what that was?
No.
He said the quote, "How can you love your country and not your government?" And I challenged the president. I would say to him, "Excuse me, Mr. President, but talk to the Germans in 1938. They can tell you how."
Clinton,
you can love your country and not love your government.
He couldn't understand how you couldn't love
your country? Yeah, he couldn't understand how you could love your country and not your government. And I kind of was shocked over that. I said, "Are you kidding me? Go talk to the Germans in 1938. They could tell you how not that you can love your country and not your government." Well, the thing is this. People need to remember a basic concept here.
Okay.
Government is nothing but people.
Right.
And people can be evil. You can elect evil people into office to where they become powerful and they can do evil things. Well, you know about the meeting that took place in 92, don't you, that think tank?
Tell me.
Oh, there was a think tank right at the end of Bush 1.
Right.
And this is all in writing, man. They put together, and it's the whole cast of characters, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Cheney, the whole group, right at the end of Bush 1. And they were commissioned to go out and study, how do we keep, now that the Soviet Union has fallen, how do we keep America as the sole superpower?
Right.
And, of course, they did a massive study, and in their summary it states, to implement everything we've suggested will take many, many years, unless a Pearl Harbor type of event were to occur.
Right.
Now, was not 9/11 a Pearl Harbor type of event? The only problem that happened in this deal was that all of a sudden in 92, Bill Clinton got elected. So what? It got put on hold for 8 years?
You're talking about the project for the New American Century, that thing?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And that's right in writing, unless a Pearl Harbor type of event were to occur.
Right. And, of course, you cite the book, The New Pearl Harbor, in your book.
Yeah.
One of the things that about 9/11 is that that hole in the Pentagon was only 16 feet deep, right?
I'm not sure, but it was far too low for a 757 to have made it without it damaging the ground, and there was no damage on the ground.
And there was no damage on the ground. There was no wreckage found, right?
No wreckage. None. And here's the part that really ticks me off. Don't quote me, but they have like 240 cameras on the Pentagon that run 24/7.
Right.
Why was it all confiscated, and why are we not allowed to see the plane hit the building?
Right. You mentioned that here, that the Department of Justice has admitted to having 85 videos, but they refused a Freedom of Information Act request to release them. What are they afraid
of? What are they hiding? What is being hidden here? What, are they saving us from having heart attacks, seeing a plane hit the Pentagon?
It would dispel a lot of suspicion in people's minds if they just released these videos, wouldn't it?
And exactly.
How about the black, like you said, this is the first time in history the black boxes have not been produced.
Yeah, and you know the story behind that with Mike Malone, the guy that worked there 250-some days? Well, he wrote a book 1 year after the event. Now, bear in mind, the 9/11 Commission wasn't even formed until 2 years after the event. I have a copy of Malone's book, and it's a book where it deals with all the cleanup. It doesn't go into who did it or anything like that, just what it was like to go there and clean this up and everything that happened. And each chapter in the book is written by two separate people so that you know that they're accurate. You're getting it from two people, not one. Well, Mike Malone's chapter and the gentleman that wrote it with him, the chapter they wrote about was the night they discovered the black boxes. And yet a year later, the 9/11 Commission states the black boxes were never found. They were destroyed. Yet you have witnesses that were cleaning up that Mike said he personally saw one, and his partner came back to him a few minutes later and said they found two more. They got three of the four. They were loaded into a black van by the FBI, and no one's ever seen them since.
I can't understand.
And the black boxes are indestructible on my TV show. Did you see my TV show where we interviewed that guy that for 35 years or 40 years, he was the top airline and crash investigator? And we asked him point blank, what are the odds that the black boxes would be destroyed and never found? And he went slim to none.
And by the way, your TV show, I'm sorry, I should have mentioned this earlier. It's True TV, right?
Right.
www.truetv.com. And I guess they could go onto that website and then just do a search for conspiracy theory, isn't it?
Yeah, Conspiracy Theory with Jesse Ventura. We did 7 episodes. It's the highest rated show in Two Channels history, and they've ordered 10 more. So we'll go back in production in about another month, and I'll probably be involved in about June 1st of doing 10 more conspiracies. And we may revisit 9/11 again, because there's way more stuff. All we did on the TV show was focus on about one or two things, because that's all we had the ability to do.
And you were saying that you live half the time in Mexico.
Yeah. I live in Mexico half the year, and I live in Minnesota the other half.
Governor Ventura, it's been a great conversation with you. And,
well, thank you very much. I appreciate it, David.
No, thank you. And congratulations. You're a best-selling author. It's number 6 right now on the New York
Times. Well, I think it went to 10, but that was before the big... We've got been 4 weeks on there, and that was before this week's media blitz again. So I got a feeling we're going to drop down again into the maybe the 4 or 5 area.
Really?
Okay. Well, yeah, because we're hitting the media. I'm doing, heck, I did 35 radio stations already this morning.
That's great. I really hope that more people, although it's a huge number of people who are obviously picking it up, but more people pick it up. Go to TrueTV.com, listen to Governor Ventura's shows, pick up his book. You have more than one book, obviously.
This is my 4th New York Times bestseller.
4th New York Times bestseller.
Yep. First one was I Ain't Got Time to Bleed, my autobiography.
Right.
The second one was called Do I Stand Alone, which I wrote 1 year after being in office, what it was like to be an independent governor.
Mm-hmm.
And I titled it Do I Stand Alone. And then, of course, there was Don't Start the Revolution Without Me, my last book. And then, of course, this one is American Conspiracies.
Which one was the highest on the New York Times bestseller list?
It Got Time to Bleed.
Okay.
Because I was so red hot at the end of the election. And I wrote an I think it went either, if it didn't go to number one, I think it made it to number two.
Wow.
Something like that. It was way up there.
You are something else, Governor. I mean, no, really. I mean, your average folk wouldn't dream of doing one of the things you do.
All I can say is this. I don't want to, when my life is getting to its end, I don't want to sit back and say woulda, coulda, shoulda.
Yeah, but you did it, though. You were successful in doing it.
Well, even if I wasn't, I don't want to be woulda, shoulda, coulda. I want to try everything.
You still have more to do?
Oh, yeah. I got to be a better surfer.
What
I'm learning now.
What about politics again?
You never know. I've learned never to say never, but at this time I have no desire, and I'll leave you with this quote. There was a great song called Long Time Gone by Crosby, Stills, Nash. In the lyrics of the song, they say, if you want to get yourself elected, you had better cut your hair. My hair's at my shoulders, so until I cut my hair, you won't see it. I got another call coming in, so I got to run.
You're the best, Governor. Thanks for your
time. Thank you. All right, bye-bye.